Honey, I blew up the business.
Welcome to the podcast. Live from NYC, we have NYC Nicole Yershon in the house.
Yay!
Woo!
Really happy to be here.
No, I'm really happy you're here because Nicole is a legend, a rock star, and I'm a big fan of hers just for various reasons, which we will get into. I'm really keen to have her on the podcast because she's a real mover and shaker in various worlds. But she's known. I'm going to embarrass you now, Nicole.
Okay.
She's known as the disruptor's disruptor. I read that on somebody's website about you.
Seriously, I love that.
Yeah.
Follow me in the direction of who wrote that.
Well, I will. I'll dig it out. In my Googling of you, I found that one. I thought you'd like that. But she's a mover and shaker and disruptor and a change maker. She's the founder and CEO of the NY Collective.
That's right.
Nicole Yershon Collective. And she's working on the front line of innovation across the piece. She's got a real history in the ad industry, but that's not just where she works. The creative intersection between advertising, media, technology, marketing, and change in general, culture perhaps, aka, and this is really what she does, brings organizations kicking and screaming into the 21st century.
I do.
She does. She started doing that at Ogilvy and Mather, which is one of the biggest, is that how you pronounce Mather, Mather?
I think it's just Ogilvy now, so.
Is it Ogilvy? One of the, how would you describe Ogilvy?
A large corporate, let's say.
Big advertising agency, global business.
Yeah, it's more marcoms. So it's not just advertising, it's everything around that.
It's one of the big ones, let's put it that way. And yeah, after leaving Ogilvy, and we'll get into what you did there, she has become a best-selling author of a book called Rough Diamond, Turning Disruption into Advantage in Business and Life. And she's the original, the OG, Rough Diamond. And she's an expert on what we call intrapreneurship, or she calls intrapreneurship, so creating businesses or business ideas within other businesses. She's an international speaker, teacher, mentor, coach, legend. And the Drum magazine, which is Europe's biggest marketing magazine, named Nicole as one of the 25 women who have shaped British digital industry over the last 25 years.
They did,
because I told you she's a legend. So we're going to get into all that. But I want to remind everybody that this podcast is brought to you by my company, The Tech Department, which is the one I blew up. Nicole and I met each other through The Tech Department. So in 2017, I blew it up. Or we all had a big nightmare year and we did turn it around. So the Tech Department is still going. But I don't want to do that again. That's why I'm speaking to Nicole, because I'm trying to learn what the bloody hell to do. And so if you like that kind of mission, I want to help other people like you listening how to run a business better so you don't blow it up. Please share the episode today, share the podcast with your friends, and like it and kind of do all that good stuff, because it helps other people, because obviously the algorithm picks up that people are liking it. So review us on Apple and all that good stuff, and that will really help us help other people like you. So I'm going to go get into it with Nicole, because she's got a really interesting career. I want to go back in time to the year 2000. Woo! We're zooming back in time like Doctor Who. And Nicole, you were brought into this advertising agency called Ogilvy. It's a classic, traditional, big, global TV, big campaign advertising agency, one of the sort of original advertising agencies. And you were told or asked by the chairman to bring the agency into the 21st century. So I was curious, what was, and for the people listening, what was the scale of that challenge?
Well, the good thing was I'd worked with the CEO and chairman at for many years at Goldwyn's Trot. When I was there with Dave Trot, he was also there. And then he set up a company called Simons Palmer, and I was there for 9 years and did some great stuff there. So he trusted me. So, and when he pulled me in with that job description, he didn't have any idea as to what it was that he wanted me to do. He just knew that he needed them brought into the 21st century, moved them from an analog world to a digital world, but didn't quite know how. And so it was my job really for the first 3 months to audit and just work out some simple quick fixes. And so there was a lot of trust there in the early days. And so it was 3 months worth of an audit, and I picked out three areas: workflow systems, finance systems, and digital asset management systems, and then looked into how we could make that digital rather than analog. So it was very civil service. It was very much paper everywhere. Job bags, things were written down, cash flow problems because loads of money was going out and estimates were done and invoices were sent out, but nothing was coming in and being paid. And so it was just really, it then started to look at, the early days of digital distribution of, okay, so there's all these TV commercials flying around the world, and there's tapes and couriers, and how can we do that digitally? So digital delivery, get rid of tapes, get rid of couriers, get rid of paper, basically. And so that was the real nasty getting stuck in. No one wanted the change. There's some kind of great stories that I talk about where they were trying to not go through the digital route and still do it analog. And I found this printer machine, this big DDS printer that was printing all these invoices for people to go off and start working. And what was happening was that they weren't actually getting the estimate approved first. So I one Friday night, I waited for everyone to go, and then I gave it a Viking's burial.
So you gave it a Viking's burial. Explain what that meant.
Blew it up, kind of sent it off into the water in flames. And so they came in on the Monday morning, and they were like, because they're like meerkats, like, where's the DDS printer? I need to get work commissioned and done. And I'd thrown it away, and so really they had to use the system that I'd put in and move them off of an analog way of working. So wow. that was the real kind of nasty stuff in the early days. TV departments saying, phoning me up saying, where's my tape? And me saying, I haven't sent it. Go to your post house and pull it down digitally. And them screaming at me, you're going to make me miss my air date. And I said, well, you're just going to have to find another way to do it. So literally cutting off the old way to enable the new way to do it. That's where it was really difficult in the early days in 2000.
So you're at the start of this process. You're in there in early, fresh in 2000. Yeah. You've got the nod from the chairman, so that's good. But then you've got this swathes of other people who don't want you to be there / don't want to change.
Yeah,
and you've done your audit, and you're focusing on these three areas, and you've got a plan. And I'm so interested that you sort of this a woman prepared to burn a printer is unleashed into the civil service of Ogilvy.
Yeah,
but two things here. One, what was going through your mind on the first day? You know, when you got the seal of approval, you got your plan approved. Yeah. What was in your mind, or how are you feeling?
Excited about possibilities, because I'd seen all these other things happening. So I saw, say, with there was an edit facility within Ogilvy, and they were using Avid, these huge Avid machines, and it was the start of Apple coming through and Final Cuts. And so I thought, okay, I'll rip all of those things out and I can put Final Cuts in, and then phones will come through and we can do these things on the phone, and then we can do digital delivery and not have to keep getting cabs to the mill in Soho when we're in Canary Wharf, and that will help the TV department not have to go backwards and forwards. And so I was just excited about what I could see was coming tech-wise, about how it was going to make life easier. But I wasn't prepared so much for the backlash of how they didn't want they didn't want to go through the pain to then get to where their life was going to be easier. But I worked it out. It was only 12 weeks of pain. So when you're implementing these new systems, it's almost like when you have a new baby and you've got to go through the pain of not sleeping for 3 months. It's that same kind of pain amount of time. But once they get through it, and once you kind of stand your ground and you've got that buy-in, then I was just excited of what we could achieve. I could only see that end goal.
So you're getting all excited, all bullish and ready to make change. And you've got this, you're hitting a bit of a brick wall low. So there's all these intransigent types. So what was the kind of, you know, how did you go about overcoming that?
I think it's very interesting, actually, because later on in my time at Open, because I was there for 16 years, and I had this great life coach, because I always like to continue learning, not just with what's going on in the outside world and bringing it back, but also for myself. And she was, she said, we really need to work on getting you out of your comfort zone. And I said, I'm always out of my comfort zone. I go to places, I know no one, I know nothing. I bring all that information back. I sift through what's going to be relevant, not relevant. And she said, yeah, but that's your comfort zone. I'm like, oh, okay. So I said, so what is out of my comfort zone? She said, actually, we need to put in a little bit more empathy there. Because when you're going through change, imagine yourself as a tank and you're just starting your journey and you can see the end goal and you just want to get there. And you're going over all these flowers and all these fields to get to the other side. But actually, imagine the flowers in the field as people, and you don't care. You're just getting there, you know, by hook or by crook. Actually, there's another way, which is where you need to stop, think, be patient. And she gave me other skills that I hadn't even really thought about. It's not that I lack empathy. I was just so focused on the change that I didn't take into account maybe people can't all come at the same time. I was thinking you either want the bus or fuck off, when actually there are other ways to do it with change to make people feel like they're coming with you, but not take up all your time and energy in trying to change everyone all the time. But just find the ones that you can, that come with you on the journey, and then a domino effect.
So how do you figure that out between your tank-like nature and squishing people under the tracks?
I went through emotional intelligence testing. So I put my whole team, I said to HR, I want to find out who works best with who are ready, who's not, what my strengths are, my weaknesses are. If they're my weaknesses, who has strengths to combat them? And so I made the team this kind of holocratic team where there was no one in charge of anyone. But our strengths and weaknesses we really started to understand ourselves much better, and a strong sense of self in understanding that someone can't get up at 7 a.m. and then function really well and be happy throughout the day. So her hours were changed to come in at 11:30 and then work and do what you can. Someone else in the team didn't want to work on Fridays, but wanted to work from home. So we changed it so that he did a 4-day week in the office and one day was working from home. So we were doing all of that in 2000. We were understanding that actually you needed diversity of thinking, which is why we set up the Rough Diamond program. You can't, you know, we were always hiring the same people. And I won't necessarily say it's a color thing, because it could be a black or a brown person thinking in the same way as a white person because they've all gone through Oxbridge.
Yeah, yeah.
I was thinking, oh, I want someone from Hackney. Whose mother might be holding down 3 jobs, whose father is an alcoholic and has left. And I wanted that kind of divergent thinking. So Rough Diamond program was set up, but all of these things were set up as responses to problems I encounter and then finding ways forward.
Interesting. So you've kind of come in the tank pursuing these goals, and it's, I guess, the original digital transformation, or a original form of digital transformation. I'm actually on a systemic level changing how people operate their jobs, which perhaps have been the same or very similar for 20, 30 years. Sure. And you're learning on that path skills, I guess, technical, but also emotional.
Soft skills that they always call soft skills, but actually we're starting to see more and more that they are highly prized skills.
And why are they highly prized skills? Or why did you find they were highly prized to you? Or were they highly prized to you?
Because you couldn't affect change properly from the core unless you understood people and how to get the best out of people and what motivated them and what made them work better.
Interesting. So you're kind of ploughing your furrow with your tank over at Ogilvy, and then around, I think it was 2008-ish, you set up the lab.
Yeah.
So what? Describe what that was and what led to that.
So on the journey of transformation, and I've implemented all these different changes, like with the edit facility and digital delivery and etc. And things were tracking along. And what I started to notice was just an absolute explosion of technology, and gaming, mobile, social, AR, VR, big data, 3D printing, behavior change. Just it was going mad. And there was no one within Ogilvy who understood any of those spaces and how we could look at a different business model so that we weren't always doing TV, press and posters, and we could actually start making money in these other areas, but we didn't really know who to go to or what the skills were or how we could bring that in to work holistically with all of these other mediums. So I kind of suggested to them, be a really nice idea if I set up an innovation lab to bring the outside world in and also start to build partnerships and relationships and different business models, and but also train the people up within Ogilvy and train our clients of a different world that was happening that advertising had never kind of stepped into. I've always had amazing buy-in with the kind of C-suite, and they said, yeah, why don't you go for it, but there's no money. We can pay you a salary, but we can't give you any money to set up an innovation lab. So I said, that's fine. And that's where I then came up with other entrepreneurial ideas, where I said, well, Rory Sutherland is I've seen him speak at client meetings, maybe I can act as his agent. Maybe I could then get in money for him to talk, and the money that I get in comes into our lab R&D pot. And then I don't need to ask for money from you. I can just start to make my own way within the organization as to what I think is relevant or not, and not go with my begging bowl each time. And so I just learn entrepreneurial ways to make money for the lab, but it not be a cost center apart from the space and salary, and start to kind of look at other ways that it was bringing in. I used to call them the six R's. So it would bring in reputation, recruitment of new staff, relationships with all these partnerships. And so I've kind of written down a theory as to how you can be measured on success, where it's not just revenue and money attributed to a client, therefore you've got the money covering your head, therefore you can stay. So I lasted really well in that way, knowing that it needed to be an R&D facility, and knowing that I needed to hit those six R's in measure of success, until a new CEO came in who just didn't have my vision, or have the vision of the last kind of 16 years worth of CEOs. They just saw a spreadsheet and needing to cross off an amount of money, and then just closed it and deleted everything that we'd ever done.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, she did.
So we first met in about, I think, 2015-ish, because my company was doing a lot of work in that kind of world of in technology, innovation, creative technology. And so 2015, 2016, or prior to this, is so 2016 was when the lab was closed. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right.
2015 was just, so I remember this vividly when it happened, because at the so 2015, in the run up to this, you guys were, let's say, flagship.
Smashing it.
Flagship innovators in and around town, around London town.
Not just London. We were pushing out. We saw talent in Newcastle with Thinking Digital, in Bournemouth with Silicon Beach, in Bristol with Pervasive Media Studios and Watershed. No, we moved ourselves around the world brilliantly.
But you were kind of, in fact, just give us a flavour for the kind of projects you were working on, the sort of clients you were working with in that sort of run-up to the 2016 switch-off time.
Well, we just won Gold Cannes Lions and awards everywhere for something we did for the unit that was that Labs had put money into to set it up to do the website and for behavior change. And that unit's still going now, Ogilvy Change. That kind of wouldn't have been around had the Labs not started.
Really?
And we run, did something called the Power of Cute, and it was working with Greenwich Council, and it was painting babies' faces on shop shutters in Woolwich to help them to then measure on that street where the crime rate had gone down, because babies' faces make people feel calmer, and it did by about 17%. So that was what they really needed to really boost setting up this Ogilvy Change department about behavior change and behavior economics. And we were that literally just four of us set that up to be done within Ogilvy. And even the creative director at the time said, I don't want it entered into awards. And I had to then go to his boss and say, he's being a CUNT, he doesn't have the vision that we have. And I know we know that that is going to pick up everything. It's smart thinking. It's the way of the future. And his boss said, you work for the group, Nick, go to one of the other Ogilvy companies. So I went to another creative director, another one of the Ogilvy companies, and they said, yeah, we'll back it. So we made the films and we put them in for awards, and it literally cleaned up.
Wow. Yeah. So you guys, I mean, just on that particular point, that is a sort of origin moment that's worthy of note, because people, well, nerds around things like Nudge, the book, and the yeah. Nudge unit in the government, yeah. all came from arguably the work that Rory Sutherland and the yeah. behavioral change team were doing at Ogilvy. So so what you facilitated and enabled and made real had ripple effects that impact us through the lockdown. I mean, this is the whole behavioral science team that were doing the three-step messaging and all that kind of stuff. So this is change that has had a profound impact. So you guys were doing this sort of stuff and leading this sort of stuff and doing these unbelievable sort of lateral thinking projects as forms of innovation on a public and private level, and winning awards for it. And then it got to 2016. And then I remember this because we were doing some work with you and your team, or working alongside in the same world. And then there was an off switch. So it seemed to be very much on and then very quickly off. And there was a tweet, which I'm going to sort of quote back to you, where you said, quote, it's with regret that Labs has been shut down.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a beautifully understated thing that you put out onto the internet, because knowing you, you weren't saying that in the pub. So what was going through your head when this whole thing was turned off?
That was very instrumental, that tweet, because that was me taking control back of the narrative. Because when the CEO cut it, she wanted me to go with the story, their narrative, which was Nico in true entrepreneurial fashion is leaving Ogilvy, and we're so sad, and you know, everything she's done has been amazing, but she kind of wants to move on to other things. I'm like, no, I don't. I love this job. You're shutting it down. Let's just be honest about it. Let's not do the whole me sign an NDA and be paid off to lie for the rest of my life. So I'd got a lawyer involved. And there was lots of discussions with my dad at the time. And I just remember thinking, I cannot sit and talk to someone who I've known forever and say, oh, yeah, it was time for me to leave. I just can't do that. So I'm just going to sign nothing, take no money, and leave with nothing. And so me sending that out was the first moment of, I'm just going to be honest and not be paid off.
I love that. So you were taking a stand.
Yeah, it makes me feel very emotional even now that it had got to that point. It was very sad.
And this is kind of what I mean, actually, because I'm knowing some of the emotional kerfuffle around in the world in which you were in, and that tweet being relatively polite. And I'm just interested, because I know that this, so it's emotive now, but what were the emotions then? I mean, when it happened and this sort of, you know, you kind of can articulate it now, but what was going through your mind?
Well, it's going to sound, you know, and I go through all of this in my book, But that was actually the third thing that had happened that where shit had seriously hit the fan in my life. I'd gone through divorce, was just bought my ex out of the house. So I had a mortgage up to here and now no job. My mum had been diagnosed with terminal cancer. And so, there's no coming back from that. It is what it is. I've been the first person in my life who kind of, where I'd had to go through that trauma. And I've been with my ex-husband since I was 14. So trauma of divorce, trauma of my mum, trauma of Labs going, which was like my baby. I'd built it from nothing with these beautiful people that we'd kind of found along the way. And if there was one thing that I'd learned from my parents is just gracious. Be grateful and be gracious. And there's no point slagging anyone off because everyone has their reasons for doing things. And the CEO's reason, actually, she stayed in employment there 3 months later. She had left. So she left Ogilvy, shut down the lab and then fucked off. But I understand business. So I understand she's got shareholders breathing down her neck. The money is drying up. Shit is hitting the fan with that industry and she's cutting costs. So she thinks she's doing everyone a favor by keeping them in employment because they're attached to a client and attached to money. And she thinks it's much better to save money with getting rid of the lab. So I didn't want to start getting into the messy area of why, because I understand why. I just wanted to be honest but gracious. And I was the same with my divorce. I never went through lawyers. I split everything down the middle. I never slagged them off to my kids. That kind of really helped me going through that process. It helped me be more kind of grown up about what was happening, more eloquent when it happened with the lab.
Yeah, it's interesting the value from your parents about being gracious.
Yeah.
You fell back on, or the fallback that you stood on. There was a bedrock for you in that moment because it'd be very easy not to be gracious. You know, there's lots of, you could windmill swinging with your arms that could have been done at the injustice of the situation. And the situation, looking back now, what do you think what were the things that got you through that period? Because that's, you say, the trauma of all these things happening all at the same time. What were the sort of values or the aspects of your character that got you through?
I think the line on my book, turning disruption into advantage, that's just what I do naturally. I won't go down that vortex. I just manage to keep myself at a level where I just keep moving forward. So I did a couple of things. I did something called Hatch in Montana. I did a talk in India, which I'd already committed to when I was at Ogilvy. I did something called Summit at Sea, which is like this mad event where all these 3,000 people get put onto a boat in the ocean, and it's like a TED meets Davos meets Burning Man. And so I did a couple of things like that. I did something called I Discover, and I just spent my time putting feelers out into spaces that were very uncomfortable for me. Going to Hatch in Montana was like kind of Planes, Trains, and Automobiles to get there. You know, the flight, the connecting flight to get to Bozeman, the journey from Bozeman to in Montana to the event. It was, you know, these things, when people see pictures on Instagram and think, oh, that's amazing, she's got an amazing life. But the effort to get there and say yes is not easy. And I didn't know anyone. So I think I did those things and I put those things in place. And then weirdly enough, on the boat, I was in a jacuzzi and I met this publisher. He said, who are you? And I said, I'm Nicole from Nicole. Like I'm a nobody, whereas it used to be Nicole from Ogilvy. And he said, oh my God, you've got some amazing stories. You should write it down. I'm a publisher. And I think it would be a really inspiring story for people, that the good and the bad. And so I said, I'm not a writer. And he said, no, let's stay in touch. And so if the lab closed in the September and I met him in the November, and we arranged for him to come to London because he lived in California in the January, And my mum died in the January. So I phoned him up and said, listen, it's not going to happen and I can't do this book. He said, but your mum knew you were going to write a book. So then I thought, oh my God, so now I'm going to have to write a book. And so, but writing the book, and I did that from the February to the July, very, very methodically, because I am a get shit done person. But the being able to get it out was actually quite cathartic.
Okay. So there's a period here of September 2016, the business blows up, as it were. Yeah. The lab blows up. And you're kind of out on your ass, basically. Exit, stays right. See you later. Yeah. And you're having to cope with that whilst the divorce is happening, which is an emotional turmoil, whilst you're navigating that whole thing with your children and your family, and then your mum and the situation with her and the terminal illness. And then you've got this period of like, I'm in a jacuzzi in a boat, like bit, which is like, cool. And then it gets this sort of, but there's this year. I'm dialing this back. Sorry, because so this September, so you've got this period of time when sort of, let's call it October, November, December-ish, where you're out around the world.
Yeah.
Throwing yourself into it. So how did so you went from a period of being Nicole from Ogilvy, and everyone's heard of Ogilvy because it's a big company that goes around the world, and now you're Nicole from just some bird from London.
Yeah, Nicole from Nicole.
No, Nicole from Nicole. So what's, how did you feel though when you were kind of going out to these big events with all these big people as this new naked Nicole? You don't have this sort of thing. So what was going on then?
Well, you feel incredibly vulnerable. You're trying to get your footing down. But then there was a part of me that just had this fuck it attitude, because I'd never had that level of freedom. Freedom from marriage, freedom from a 9-to-5 day job, freedom from my kids were that much older. And I actually was the first time I could have a little bit of movement. So that, I guess, helped me. I could have gone the other way, but I just see the positives, and I'm an optimistic personality. And I just didn't allow myself to fall down that pit. I don't know why I didn't. Maybe my personality type, you know, the Myers-Briggs, you know, ENFP or whatever. I'm really not sure. Or maybe it was during that time I had the right help. I discovered was really good for me. It was looking at oneself and looking at who you are. And I'd done a little bit of coaching before that. So all those things helped to take responsibility for who I am and my decision making. So I guess in answer to your question, those things were put in place and guided me and helped me keep it moving forward.
Interesting. So you're soaking in all this sort of all these influences and information, and guess not allowing yourself to go down a wormhole. And then you've got this the death of your mother at the same time of the birth of the book.
Yeah.
And it's interesting how there's a sort of I know you've spoken about serendipity before.
Mm.
And it's interesting looking at it, this is this year, September through July.
Yeah.
Where old Nicole, the identity, the job, the family structure, lots of things faded away or went away. Yeah, blew up. And then new Nicole started to be born. Yeah. Looking back now, because it's a few years ago now.
Yeah.
How does that feel? You know, that time, and can you, you know, make sense of it? And what's the sort of serendipitous nature threading through that?
But obviously not about my mom, but everything else was thank God. Oh my God, they did me a favor. I didn't even know it. Took me a while to get through that. But looking back, they are my feelings, because now could I work with, like, have a 9-to-5 job working for companies and I couldn't now. I'm so used to being like going from an intrapreneur to the entrepreneur. I thank them for allowing me to do that and how much money has been put in my pension as a result of running my own business and stuff that I would have just been a salaried employee. I wouldn't have learned what I've learned about finance and running my own company and money coming in and money going out and business acumen has just gone sky high. Because in comparison to working for someone else, you don't know how to run a business. So that in terms of has really, really helped. And the marriage thing, being married was living the same day, the same year, the same month, every day, the same day, and calling it a life. You know, my diary, I'd see things booked up for in 6 months on Saturday nights, and it'd be the same Saturday night, the Friday night dinner, the Sunday deli, the whatever it was. I was not. Now I just say yes to everything, just for. And people might again look at the Instagram and think, "Oh, she's got a great life." I make that by making certain choices. Like, so I'm in New York for 5 weeks, but I'm up at 5 o'clock in the morning most mornings for meetings and calls. So from 5 until 2, I'm working. I'm just working from anywhere. I'm just working from New York. So it might look like I'm having the whale of a time, and I am, but I make those choices to have that. Have those moments so I'm not living the same day over and over again and 10 years down the line and all of a sudden I'm 10 years older and I don't have those experiences to show for it.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's you've really embraced the change and the switch up of that time and yeah. Sort of and live it out. And so you're working from anywhere. You literally are dialing in from NYC. And so, yeah. So is this the thing you're doing now? Is this just sort of an opportunity you've taken to be out there? Are you working from anywhere all the time or just
for periods? I just thought, well, my partner does a lot of work in North America. So, you know, he's been to Washington. And then he could come back to New York as a base. He's going to Chicago for a job, and then he'll come back to New York as a base. So rather than flying back to London, backwards and forwards, we just thought, well, let's just see what it could be like where New York would be his base, as he has loads of stuff here anyway. And what would it be like for me in terms of how can I still run my business working with my clients? And we've been doing it on Zoom for the last couple of years anyway, haven't we? So it doesn't actually feel very odd that they see me on a screen.
Yeah, very true. And it's interesting because we went fully remote as a business and, well, early in lockdown, because frankly, there was no point renewing the lease. It was very apparent. But this idea of working from anywhere is something that we've sort of threatened a little bit, and I've not really done it. So I'm intrigued to see how you're finding it in practice.
I love it. I absolutely love it, and I would do it again over and over again because I think you make it work. And as long as it's fine with everyone else, like I've said to them, don't change the meeting times. I'll just fit in with how, you know, if the meeting's at 10 o'clock and it's been set every Wednesday, then I'll just dial in at 5 in the morning. And you just kind of make it work. So, and 5 weeks we kind of felt was a long enough period of time for us to see whether it does work. And I found great little ways to save money. So we flew from Paris rather than London and saved a fortune with airfare. Now it's a pain to go on Eurostar, go to Paris, stay overnight at the airport, hotel, and then fly from Paris, but it was so much cheaper. I've done the same with, I found something called Sonder, which is it's not Airbnb and it's not a hotel, so you're living in this kind of turnkey apartment, and you keep it clean, you don't have maids come in or anything, and you get your own grocery shopping, and you literally live your life in a turnkey apartment where you can stay for one day, 3 months, 5 weeks, and it feels like home.
So you got home from home.
Yeah.
Over in New York for 5 weeks. That's interesting. How long have you been there?
We came on the 2nd of April and we leave on the 8th of May.
So we're recording this in, well, I mean, it's not going to go out until a bit. So middle of April. So interesting. So I'm going to, I'm inspired. I'm going to start looking at, yeah, I'm fancying a bit of that. That's great. So you've got this amazing life doing entrepreneurial innovation stuff with big companies. And what's the sort of, give us an insight sort of projects you're working on now and how you're using these skills that you, and that you've built over these years to sort of help drag more companies into the 21st century.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've got lots of experience in terms of, so I was working with Danone for a while and I did a big project and big budget, and it was kind of pulling all of the right teams together depending on what it was that we were trying to do. But they wouldn't allow to pay for anyone else other than me. So I was the holder of this budget, and that was the first experience of someone who I pulled in from the collective invoices me and wants to be paid within a week. Someone invoices and wants to be paid within a month, and yet they didn't pay me for maybe 60 days. So then now working with another client, I said to the finance director, we've got maybe 10 different companies that we're working with over on this project. I'm not going to hold the purse strings and I'm not going to take, so therefore they're paying me retainer. But then they've got to pay these companies exactly when they say they want to be paid. No 60-day or 90-day or how it's been with SMEs and how they get paid, and because most of them get crushed with cash flow.
Quite, yeah.
So, and the good thing was I've never had an office space since I've left Ogilvy, but I always work from Soho House. So having that membership, there's 3 Soho Houses here. So, and plus Sonda, it is a building with a gym and with meeting room space.
Right. Okay.
So I've kind of looked around and really kind of made sure that it's going to fit into the life that I'm living. So that was good experience with Danone in working out how we should get paid. But I've been working with small companies as well. So I was working at the beginning of the year with the Young Vic. And I was instrumental in helping set up a mentorship program for them. So it was mentoring the mentors who were mentoring the mentees, but it was a reverse mentorship program. So the mentors were the kids and the mentees were people that run their own companies, like very senior people. So it was great because I could help the mentors with any kind of imposter syndrome because they thought, what can I tell these people who've been running the show for ages, but they couldn't understand what they were giving to the mentees in terms of their age, their generation, their thought process, their inspirations, events that they've been to that we would never have heard of, how they go about doing their business and their work, how they work on Google Docs and like all of these different things. It was an amazing program to see the mix of learning. So that was quite interesting. I'm working on a lab for a vet company that are building a vet hospital of the future with a brand new business proposition. So the insight was that they were finding vets were killing themselves quite literally over COVID times because they hadn't been trained to deal with people. They're trained to deal with animals. And then they've got the financial element on top of it and they haven't really been trained on that either. Wow. And therefore people are saying, you know, their animal needs to be put down and that's going to be £1,000. And that level of conversation, it just... So this is a new business model. It's a new vet school that is going up within Keele University. And then with that, we'll attach a lab and we'll have various things in there as to how we can teach the kids that are coming through that 5-year program, but also how we can teach the people and the vets that are within the hospital. So all very different.
Yeah, it's amazing. And I think it's interesting to get a flavour of different ways of thinking about not just new technology, but new ways of working, new ways of engaging with other people, new ways of thinking about dealing with problems. And so I think this is so I would very much encourage everyone to sniff out what Nicole's up to, because she's got a really amazing view of the world, which I think anyone running a company, an entrepreneur or someone within a business can learn from in terms of looking at the world differently. And that's what innovation really is, or disruption is change. I like to ask people this question just before we finish up. But so there's lots of advice for entrepreneurs out there. What advice should entrepreneurs ignore?
The word no, because there's always someone somewhere that can help. Unless it fundamentally is really not working and you've been patient and you've given it time. But I think most entrepreneurs have the ability that we're super connectors. So if we don't know, we know someone that does. And so there's normally someone who can help and will give their time, not have the piss taken out of them. But like my friend, you know her, Katie Bell.
Yeah.
So Katie sent me a note this morning saying, gave me an update on all the different things she's doing. And I've maybe connected her to 5 different people where her skills and what she's doing right now are extremely relevant. And she's written back saying, please, how can I help you? And I said, well, there's nothing right now, but I don't know what's going to happen in the future. So let's just stay talking. And so that's how we work together. We entrepreneurs in general is... I know I can call upon someone who, or even you. When was the last time we saw each other? Maybe 6 years ago?
Oh, yeah, probably, yeah. Quite a while ago.
And there's a respect and value where we understand how to do business, which is decency and kindness, and our value systems seem to work. So in answer to your question, what advice wouldn't they listen to?
Or should they ignore?
Should they ignore? I would say probably the word no, because anything is possible.
I love it. Anything is possible. Today's T-shirt in the merch shop, which we haven't developed yet, is Anything is Possible by Nicole Yershon.
Yeah.
Well, listen, that's a fantastic... Well, listen, it's what a great story. Thank you for sharing so openly. And it's so inspiring. And so, and genuinely, I'm making notes about bloody flying to New York and working for 5 weeks. So I'll see you next week. And where should people find you online? Where should people connect with you?
I always say this, and this, I thank my parents for this. There's no other Nicole Yershon. So
there's literally only one.
There's only one.
There's only one Nicole Yershon.
It sounds so arrogant and ridiculous, but so therefore I just made everything Nicole Yershon. LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, website. As long as obviously you can spell it, you'll find me and just reach out.
We will put all these links into the description in the podcast. Yes. and just Google it and you'll find her. And she's and well worth checking out and connect with her and think of her when you're doing your next innovation project. What an absolute joy. Thanks for coming. Stay on the line when we stop chatting now. And then we'll see you all next time, everyone. Bye.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Do you want to get the top 5 tidbits from each episode emailed to your inbox every Friday? Yes, you do. It saves you having to go through and make notes and make a note of all the books and all the ideas that are in the podcast. We go through and we choose the top 5 we like, plus put all the links into that email. So if you just go up to honeyibluepthebusiness.com, yes, that's honeyibluepthebusiness.com, and just enter your email address. There's a little box. Just enter it in and we will send you that information. And it saves you having to make notes and all that. That's make your life a bit easier. And of course, if you did enjoy the episode, please consider subscribing. We are trying to help people through this. So the more people that subscribe, review, rate on Apple, Google, Podcasts, Spotify, the more people will see it and the more we can help. So help us help other people, other entrepreneurs like you. And before I go, I've got to say big up to my company, the tech department, the company we blew up and put back together again. They're generously supporting me on this mission through the podcast. So if you guys want to have a look at a company that can really help you improve your technology, make it better so your business gets better too, boosting your sales and your profit and a bit more sanity in your life, a little less stress, then head up to thetechdept.com, the tech department. My company, give us a look. On behalf of all of us here, thank you for listening, and I'll see you next time.